This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, we have with us by telephone Mary Mackey, who is Professor Emeritus of English and former writer in residence at California State University, Sacramento. She is related through her father's family to Mark Twain. She graduated magna cum laude from Harvard, receiving her PhD in comparative literature from the University of Michigan. After receiving her PhD, Mary moved to California and became professor of English at California State University, Sacramento, where she became one of the founders of the Women's Study Program and also of the English Department's Graduate Creative Writing Program, along with poet Dennis Schmitz and novelist Richard Bankowski. In 1978, she founded the Feminist Writers Guild with poets Adrienne Rich and Susan Griffin and novelist Valerie Miner. She then, later, from 89 to 92, served as president of the West Coast branch of Penn American Center, involving herself in Penn's international defense of persecuted writers. During her 20s, she lived in the rainforests of Costa Rica, and recently she's been traveling to Brazil and incorporating her experiences in the tropical rainforests into her fiction and poetry. Mary has published 8 volumes of poetry and also is the author of 14 novels. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm really glad to be able to talk with you. And one of the most exciting things is the news you have of your newest collection of poems, The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. You called it your most important collection of poetry to date, spanning over 40 years of your work, from the early days of second wave feminism to the present, including poems about the rainforests of Central and South America, where you lived off and on over years. So I'm wondering what you can tell us about the excitement of having a new collection out.
This is a retrospective of my work, plus it has about 48 new poems, so and it's exciting in itself to just see how your work comes together in a body. But I've had some really good news lately. When the book came out, the day it came out, it sold out, which was a surprise to me, and the press put in a second printing, Marshot Press. And then about 10 days ago or so, it made the small press distribution bestseller list, which was great. And then about a week ago, it won the Women's Spirituality Book Award. So nothing but good news, which is very rare these days, to have several days of really good news and nothing else.
Right. Congratulations. It's very exciting.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And speaking of the bad news, of course, I think there's an intersection between what we have to do as a world and your poetry. And I'm wondering which of your poems you might think could spur children who might hear your poetry in school, adults who have bought your poetry, to take some action.
I've been interested in these issues for many, many years because I spent time in the rainforest of Costa Rica, particularly when they were completely at their prime. Nothing had been cut down, and I saw it in all its beauty and diversity with all the different animals. We all know the bad news, but I think one thing we have to think about to inspire us is the beauty we're protecting, the treasure of it. And so I've written a poem called Witness, which is for future generations to describe the beauty and to bear witness. And I think the most important thing a poet can do right now is bear witness to her time or his time. It's a long poem, but I'm going to read the essence of it to you, and I hope it will be inspiring. Witness. There were once beasts called elephants. When one could not get food, the others fed her. They were taken for their tusks, which were made into bracelets and piano keys, and their feet, which were made into footstools. The seals were made into hats and coats. The salmon were fished out of the rivers and eaten. The ostriches were taken for plumes for hats. The giraffes became seat covers. Swordfish were served in fine homes on long polished tables covered with exotic sauces. The bones of wild mules were ground up for glue. Soon, only the oldest of us could remember a time when we woke to the humming of locusts, when a coyote danced in the sagebrush, a beaver felled a tree, a rhinoceros bathed in the mud, and wild roses bloomed in the ditches beside the roads. On summer evenings, large birds used to cross the thin golden plate of the sun. In the forest, the whippoorwills sang all night long.
That poem makes me happy and sad at the same time, because sad about the wealth and diversity of the organisms of this earth being so diminished, and then I feel happy that I get to see some of that right now, even today.
Yeah. We have an incredible treasure right now. I've dived the Great Barrier Reef when it was alive and well. I had the pleasure of seeing the glaciers of Alaska. I've been in the rainforest. I feel incredibly gifted. These may not be things, if we don't take action, that people will ever see again.
Being witness is a way of taking action because it changes us to want to preserve what we can. Thank you very much. You are part environmentalist in your poetry, part feminist in your poetry. You say that some of your poems have been inspired by the high fevers you endured as a child. So we'll try to talk about all of that in our half hour together. I've been so taken with the fact that finally in our popular media, the movies, the issue of women not being as well published as men, women writing for men who get the accolades, and these are films like The Wife and Colette currently showing. I'm wondering, and you have this background in starting feminist organizations with feminist poets. Tell me more about that in your poetry.
I was set on fire by a kind of discrimination I discovered in college. This is absolutely true. It's almost unbelievable. When I went to Harvard, I was not allowed to use the undergraduate library.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I was a woman.
Really?
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg wasn't either, which I think is fun to know because we were both turned out. Women were supposedly distracted men, so we were not allowed to enter the library, although we paid the same tuition, we took the same exams, and we have the same diploma. And the women who worked there had to go through special little hallways where they couldn't be seen. The Poetry Room of Harvard, a massive and wonderful collection, is in Lamont Library, but I never saw it, and I was never allowed to go to the readings of the famous writers who came because I couldn't go into Lamont. So when Ginsburg read, I couldn't go see him. So this actually didn't discourage me. It made me determined to level the playing field. So I started out, when I started teaching, I taught a course for, men were always welcome in the courses, but I taught a course where women would write their own biographies, their mother's biographies, and their autobiographies, and then I gathered with other women to form small presses, to make places where women, to set up writing groups. The feminist writing group set up women's writing groups around the country to help get women poetry published and also to help women support one another in overcoming the kind of incredible discrimination that was going on. We made massive changes in the culture of poetry. Women's poetry had no respect at all when I first started writing, and of course now it has gained a great deal. And I think that has been one of the things I've been able to contribute, which I'm very happy about. And I also wrote a kind of classic essay for Small Press Review called Why Women's Poetry Doesn't Get Published. Now, this was 1972. And I said, because it was understandable. It wasn't so obscure and abstract that it made you feel inferior when you read it. Like, are you up to reading this poetry? And I thought that was one of the problems, that it had a different tactic on life, that it went for communication versus power.
Wow. What a story. I'm still hung up on you're attending Harvard and cannot use the library?
No, you couldn't.
Our
books for our courses were on reserve there, and we had this pokey little library. Radcliffe did the best it could, which was the women's organization within Harvard. But the books were in Lamont.
And not being able to go to the readings, also the men wouldn't be distracted.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and also there was at least a rumor of, and I think it was true, that women couldn't go to dinner with famous people because, quote, women brought down the tone of the conversation.
Except for our current vice president, we've come a long way.
We have come a long way, but it really, instead of crushing me, it just made me, it didn't make me mad exactly, it made me incredibly stubbornly determined. I'm a very stubborn person.
Thank goodness. Thank you. So I know from some of what I've read about your work that some of the poems you say from the early years of women's movement sound as if they could have been written yesterday. Some of these poems appear in a section called A Threatening Letter to Shakespeare, in which five of Shakespeare's heroines talk back, giving their side of the story. Juliet, for example, wonders why she ever married Romeo. And stubborn and funny. And so do you have something from that series you might read to us?
Yeah, and obviously it's funny and serious at the same time, which is kind of my specialty, because I think you communicate better with people if you don't just rage. There's nothing like satire and humor to communicate an idea. And so I'm going to read you Juliet.
Okay.
Juliet, I was a green girl, 14 and fresh. My breasts curled so tight in my chest that they ached. Time pulled through my body like sap, and I thought love grew everywhere like milkweed. Romeo was a human swagger. We drove over the state line near the end of spring and were married by a judge in striped pajamas who loaned us a cigar band for a ring. I said, look how the dogwood is in bloom, like the lips of small children in the naked woods. And Romeo said, let's stop for a cheeseburger. I said, when I see a river, I imagine a mouth at the end that could swallow us both. I said, this is the beginning of a great adventure. I have escaped into love, and I'll never be unhappy again. But there was wax to take off the kitchen floor, and diapers to wash, and Romeo snored, and I found that love grows around the heart like the bark on a tree, and we had three children, and nobody died, and you can wait forever for the balcony scene.
So true, all of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and Desdemona, Cleopatra, Lady Macbeth, and Ophelia all get theirs, too, in that section. They get to talk back.
All right, and tell our listeners again the book name that these appear in.
The name of the book is The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, New and Selected Poems, 1974 to 2018, by me, Mary Mackey, and published by Marsh Hawk Press.
And that volume is in its second printing as we speak. Exciting.
Actually, it may go into a third, looks possible.
I hope so. You also have written about the poems in that book, about being inspired by the high fevers you had since early childhood. Mm-hmm. You called them dark, serious, visionary, and lyrical. What's the link between the fevers and the poems?
Well, my poems, besides having these other qualities, have a kind of mystical quality, a kind of quality that expresses something that really can't be expressed in words. And I attribute this to the fevers because I have run probably about 8 times in my life, fevers close to 107. Up to 105, you feel really horrible. But once you get over 105, you get this bizarre elation. The world looks different. It kind of changes. You see it differently. You see things. You hear things. You see reality becomes a kind of pane of glass, and you see things behind it. I mean, I'm not saying I'm a prophet. I'm not trying to start a religion. But I think I've had some sense of what mystical poets like Mirabai and St. John of the Cross and Blake may have experienced, that kind of other reality. And so that permeates my poetry, a kind of larger vision of something bigger than the kind of reality we're in right now. I've also, when I get these very high fevers, I have witnesses to this, I tend to speak in rhyme couplets uncontrollably, and I've sometimes spoken in rhyme couplets for up to 4 hours. And you feel really great. Everybody else is running around saying, she's dying, and you're saying, it's okay, I don't care, it's fine, don't worry about it. It wouldn't be an experience I would choose, but I don't have it when I don't have fevers, but it's been heavily influential, I think, on my attitude toward words and reality itself.
Interestingly, though, you're having a good time. You're describing it as enjoying speaking in rhyme couplets, but the poems themselves are dark and serious.
They often are very dark and serious in their ways, although sometimes they're not. I mean, I have a poem called Breaking the Fever, which is actually the title poem for one of my books, which gives you the sense of the kind of ecstasy of the fever. But the poems also will have dark moments. I can read you one of the dark ones if you want, or I could read you one of the light ones.
Well, maybe you could read both of them if you're prepared to do that.
They're short.
So we can, yeah. Okay, thanks.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with California poet, novelist, and emeritus professor Mary Mackey about her writing and her career efforts to advance environmental awareness and women's opportunities to publish their writing.
I'll read the light one first, and then I'll read the darker one. This is called Breaking the Fever. I'm going to read you actually an extract of it because it's a little long. Breaking the Fever. When I was young, fevers were attacked. The grown-ups would rub you with alcohol, wrap you in wet sheets, refuse you blankets, fan you, feed you aspirin, plunge your wrists in cold water. They knew fever had to be fought because it let children see forbidden things. At 105, I would start to hear voices, soft and lulling. At 106, the faces would appear, swimming around me, stretching out their hands. They would gesture to me to join them. I was always very happy then, floating out on the warm brink of the world. The fever children would sing in high voices, liquid like silver bells. Come with us, they'd say. Come play, Mary. And they'd show me maple trees turning red and gold, long aisles of sunlight, and woods that glowed and trembled. My body would start to come apart, very gently, like milkweed fluff, and I'd begin to rise toward their hands. But always at the last moment, the dark circle of grown-up faces would force me back down, and their fear would pin my chest to the mattress like black crystal paperweights. I would see my mother's pale, terrified face, and my stuffed animals, and my brother's crib, and my precious fever would lie broken in 1,000 bits, with no way to put it back together, and I could never explain how kind it had been, how foolish we were to fear it.
Mm.
A darker one here is called 105 Degrees and Rising. All these poems are in The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. 105 Degrees and Rising. It lifts me from my bed in an ascending spiral, whispering my name over and over like a disappointed lover, gripping me in its claws, gagging me with its shadow, until my flesh turns to iron and the world becomes a pane of glass so brittle I can break it with my tongue.
Very evocative of that state, and I think it maybe applies to moods we can get into and fearful times,
yeah.
As well as
feverish
times.
Yeah, it does, and it kind of meshes with all of those things. There's
yes.
kind of an expansiveness in that.
Thank you for all the experience so far. Poetry is something that you can savor every poem, and I'm going to listen again. It will be both aired and in available podcasts, so those of us who want to re-listen can hear your poetry again.
Okay.
I look forward to that very much. Let's turn to your novels. You've written many of those, and sort of unusual for a poet to also write novels, so tell us about this.
Novel ideas are much more rational. They come to me as plots. I'm a storyteller. I'm the kind of person, if we lived in the Neolithic, I would be sitting around the campfire telling the rest of you stories, whether you wanted to hear them or not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, before I could read, I told stories to other kids, and I discovered that if I stopped at good places, they'd give me candy to go on. You know, so I was encouraged at a very early age in this. These kind of narratives, I come from my Kentucky background, where my family would sit on the porch of this very small farm in western Kentucky after they'd worked like crazy all day, and they just tell stories. And the stories were an oral tradition. Some of them, they had gossip that was 300 years old that they were still telling. Raised in this oral narrative tradition, which I think is partly what, by the way, makes many Southern writers, American writers, Southern writers write, I told stories. But at the same time, I had this kind of poetic element, too, that comes. It's much more personal, it's more immediate, and it's less rational, and it comes much faster, and it comes, I think, more deeply out of the subconscious. So these are just two sides of something I do. They're not entirely separate. They're just part of the same creative force that kind of blossoms up in different ways from time to time.
Wow. So the stories come more easily than the poems?
No, the poems come faster than the story. It takes 2 to 3 years to write a novel, and I write a rough draft of a poem in one sitting. I never show my rough drafts. I work over them 12, 18 times, but the first impulse of it is a very quick impulse. It kind of pours out almost automatically.
Does that continue to happen while you're working on novels as well?
When I'm working on novels or when I'm working on nonfiction, like when I wrote a doctoral dissertation, your mind is so engaged in the rational, because writing a novel is like planning a huge conference. You know, there's just so many demands and things and research that you have to do that it pretty much suppresses the poetic impulse. So when I'm writing novels, I'm not writing poetry. And when I'm writing poetry, I'm not writing novels. I tend to do them separately. I might write an occasional poem, but the great bursts of writing poetry or writing an entire novel are kind of separate parts of my writing personality, my brain, that work at different times. So
is your brain in charge, Mary? It says, okay, it's novel time.
Sort of, yeah. I taught and I wrote 14 novels and I wrote these books of poetry all the while I was working. I'm very good at compartmentalization. When I'm doing something, I'm doing it with all my heart and soul. So when I was teaching, I was there for my students. I was completely teaching on the days I was teaching. And then when I was home and writing, I was completely writing. So I think the two things, you know, compartmentalization and the fact that I'm really organized have helped me be able to do this.
So it sounds like it's natural for you, but I wonder if you could do workshops on that. I think a lot of people would like to learn how to do that.
Well, I did. I mean, I taught this for over 30 years at the university. I taught creative writing and film.
But you didn't necessarily teach compartmentalization, which would be very handy.
I don't know if that can be taught. But I can teach organization. I mean, let me just put it this way. My spices are in alphabetical order.
Oh, my goodness. So before we get too far from your novels, did you have an excerpt from one of them prepared to read?
Yes, I want to read an excerpt from The Village of Bones, which is the prequel to my best-selling Earth Song series. And it's about the goddess-worshipping cultures of Europe 6,000 years ago, Neolithic Europe. And in this passage, a young priestess, her sailboat's turned over in a huge storm and she's drowning, and then she has a very interesting vision. Now, to understand what this all means, you have to know that she is the mother of the heroine of my other novels. That woman, Mara, fights off a nomadic invasion that brings patriarchy, genocide, and war into a Europe that hasn't known it before. And this is actually based on the research of a woman named Maria Gimbutas, an archaeological researcher. So it has a lot of basis in fact, but of course my characters are made up because I have not been able to go back in time, and there's no time machine, so I have to do it that way. So I'm going to read you this moment of her vision. So she's lying sobbing because the waves are crashing over her. She's just fought her way to the surface, and she's hanging on a spar of the boat. As she lay there sobbing, giving in to the grief that had been bubbling up in her throat ever since the boat capsized, a woman emerged from the wall of crashing waves and walked across the sea toward her. Sabala abruptly stopped crying and stared at the woman, stunned. This was impossible. She had to be dreaming. The woman kept walking, stepping over the waves as if they were furrows in a field of wheat. Her flowing dress was blue as a summer sea, her hair long and green, twined with seaweed and pearls. Her skin was dark and light at the same time, her eyes so bright they glowed like the last flash of the sun when it falls into the sea in midsummer. Sabala closed her eyes and clung to the mast, trembling. A sweet scent suddenly filled the air, like the perfume of roses blown across water. "Don't be afraid," the woman said. "I'll do you no harm. Open your eyes and look at me." Sabala opened her eyes and saw the woman was standing on the water, so close to the mast that the hem of her robe was touching it. Repressing an urge to scream in terror, she summoned all her courage. "Who are you? How can you walk on water? You don't recognize me?" Sabala shook her head and felt salt water drain out of her ears. The woman's laughter was like the sound of a wind chime. "I'm Amona, goddess of the sea, and water's my path. I can walk above it or beneath it as I wish." That's the opening of The Village of Bones.
So the opening tells me, again, how much work you've done to further women's literature and the practice of writing it and also publishing it. And its strength and its necessity. And I just want to thank you for all that work.
Well, thank you.
And all the products of that work.
It hasn't been work. It's been a great pleasure, actually. Well,
maybe that's how it could happen so thoroughly and for such a long period of time. And I'm feeling like if anyone could find that time machine as a writer, it would be you, Mary. So let's talk about screenplays. So poems and novels, and how do the screenplays fit into your writing life?
When I first came to California, I didn't have a teaching job, and so I went to a seminar for women and minorities given by NABIT, which is a organization of engineers, technicians, and people involved in sound. And I was trained to be a sound recordist for film, location film. Since I was the only woman who showed up, no minorities or any other women showed up, I had 20 very nice men who were experts in their field teach me how to do film sound. So for a while, I was the only woman film recordist in the Bay Area. And I did a lot of things on live locations, and I sort of thought, I'm carrying this heavy recorder, but I can actually write. So maybe if I could write screenplays, then I wouldn't have to carry this 30-pound Nagra around with me. So I put a little folder in my union hiring thing, and bizarrely enough, because they shouldn't have looked there, people found it and hired me to write a film script. So I wrote my first film script, and it got made, and I got feature credits. I got in the Writers Guild. I got a little prize because it was about a disabled child, and that kind of set me off on writing screenplays. And I subsequently adapted one of my novels for Warner Brothers, although they didn't publish it, and I just kept going, and I'm still writing screenplays with my script-writing partner, Renee De Palma, in Hollywood, and we've got some things going around, and it's a long haul with screenwriting, but from time to time things happen. So I've always liked it. It's more like a blueprint than a novel, and it's much shorter, of course, than a novel, too.
Mary, what's the name of the film that did get made?
It's called Silent. Not to be confused with Bergman's The Silence.
Right. And is it something that's available today?
I don't know. It might be. Yeah. People tell me they've seen it. So you might be able to find it somewhere. It was a children's film. It was about a little deaf boy who got lost in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And it was made a long time ago. And I made it very inexpensively for them because he was deaf. You didn't need sync sound for the movie. So it could be filmed and then the sound could be put in later because I was an expert on sound at that point because I'd been doing sound.
And the name of the adaptation from your novel, the same as your novel?
It was McCarthy's List, which is my comic novel about a woman who she's totally insane, but she's basically doing in all of her old boyfriends who abused her, harassed her, betrayed her, attacked her, but she's doing them in comic ways. Like she sends one an exploding parrot, for example. You know, it's not dark. It's funny, hilarious, and extremely bizarre. I'm thinking I should get it back in print. It's called McCarthy's List.
Yeah, I think you should, especially in these times. It might.
Yes.
It might cheer us up. And also,
right. Oh, it definitely would cheer you
right,
up.
And address the problems.
It's available on Kindle. I mean, it's just not available in hardback.
Oh,
yet.
Well, that is...
All my books are available as e-books.
Okay, so let's take a moment then to talk about your website so that people can find all the titles.
My website is pretty easy to remember. It's marymackey.com, MaryMackey.com. It has descriptions of all the books with little summaries. It has free samples of poems. It has a nonfiction piece about a night I was swarmed by army ants in Guatemala, which also has its funny moments. And it has a guide to women writers' archives. And it has pictures of artifacts from the goddess-worshipping cultures of old Europe. So that's marymackey.com.
Thank you. So we could get quite an education through you, through
and
your
you
website.
Have some fun. Those artifacts, those statues from the goddess-worshipping cultures are absolutely beautiful. They're amazing.
How did you find them?
I went to Romania and Bulgaria with a woman named Joan Marler, who was writing about the area, and with my husband, and we went to different museums and got permission to take pictures of these artifacts.
I have to ask this before we end. You're so enthusiastic. You're so energetic. You're so stubborn in a good way to get your points across. Are there some major obstacles at all?
Sure. You know, like everyone else, I wrote 5 novels before I could get one published. I have my moments of down and depression, and I have moments when I think I'm no good. And I've never written a novel where in the middle of it I didn't come to somebody, and at this point in the last 30 years or so, to my husband and say, this is horrible, it's never going to work, I'm going to throw it away, what am I doing? So I'm beset by doubts like everybody, but I just don't give up. I think it's the stubbornness. I just get through those things and I just fight my way back to some kind of level place and just start up again.
I don't suppose any of those people have said, yeah, you're right, Mary, throw that novel away.
No, what they usually say is you always say this. And sometimes I am right. Sometimes they're not working. But I always have great doubt somewhere about 150 pages in.
So it's good to recognize your own rhythms there.
Yes. Each time I actually believe it's the absolute truth.
Absolutely. I understand that completely. And I'm so happy that you shared that, because so many people listening are writers and think if they feel that way, that makes them not a writer. So listening
right.
to you.
And, you know, every morning when I get up to write, it's like climbing a mountain. I just have to do it. And it's always hard. And there's so many more interesting and easy things to do. So, I mean, that's also always a barrier just to get started. So I have a deal. I have to sit there in front of my computer, and I either have to write on what I'm writing or I have to write about how I can't write. And I have volumes and volumes that I've kept about how I can't write. And I used to keep them in my office with my published books underneath and all that stuff on top. And I'd say, that stuff on top is how I can't write. And this is what happened because I kept going.
So you had a visual reminder.
Yeah, I did. And I tell you, if you write about how you can't write long enough, you will get so bored you will start writing.
That's a great way for us to end. It's a wonderful message that when we address the obstacle, we can dissipate it. So I want to thank you so very much for everything you've shared with us. And congratulations again on the good success of the new poetry collection. And
we'll
be looking at your website and learning more and more.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.